Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC AM and FM New York, AM 820, 93.9 FM, and WNYC.org. The Brian Lehrer Show is not live today, so we won't be taking any calls. But we thought we'd take this opportunity to bring you some of our favorite recent segments. So enjoy, and remember that our comments page is always open. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. So just before the break, I asked for two icons of writing who have said having too many books was evil. Call right up if you think you know which two I'm thinking of, as we welcome Clay Shirky, a faculty member at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at NYU. Shirky has been thinking about the explosion of free time worldwide. Oh, and the phone number 212-433-WNYC. If you want to take a stab at those two icons of writing who said having too many books was evil, 212-433-9692. So Clay, who you may know from his previous book, Here Comes Everyone, or was it Everybody, Clay?
Everybody.
Here Comes Everybody. He's now thinking about the invention of the 40-hour work week and how that has led to a cognitive surplus, essentially the amount of extra mental activity that we've been capable of ever since. So what do we do with that surplus? And how is the internet harnessing it for good, in his opinion, instead of for TV reruns? That's the subject of his new book, Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. And Clay, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's see who's on to you here. Ross in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I was going to take a crack. One of them, I would say, is the Russian-American poet Joseph Brodsky, who didn't believe in keeping too many books.
And? Oh, just that. That's your guess. That's one of them. But unfortunately, that's not one that we were thinking of. Let's see. Should we try Nick in Manhattan? Nick, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I'm going to say Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and John le Carré.
No, but this is fun. So let's go to Christopher in New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, this is Christopher. I actually didn't have an answer. I just wanted to weigh in real quick and just say that I think keeping too many books is just terrible. Every time I read a book, I give it away to somebody else, and hopefully they pass it on.
You're a one-man internet. Kevin in Westbury, you're on WNYC.
Okay, it's Evan in Westbury. I would guess Mark Twain is one.
Sorry. So it's time to give it away, Clay.
All right. The two I quoted in the book, and I should say it's a sentiment that's been expressed more than twice. The first one, funnily enough, was Martin Luther, who was one of the original users of the printing press as a source of social upheaval driving the Protestant Reformation. And his complaint was that too many people were driven to write books just to hear themselves talk or for fame. And then in the 1800s, in the middle of the 1800s, Edgar Allan Poe, who said, "Now that we have all of these books, we hardly know what to think anymore. You have to lumber through all of them just to get a handful of facts."
And they both use the word evil from the quotes that are in your book.
Exactly right.
So why compare what those two men thought about books once upon a time to where we are at in the current moment with the internet?
Well, so one of the core observations of Cognitive Surplus of the book is that abundance breaks more things than scarcity, right? When a society has something scarce, it knows how to manage it, it treats it as a precious resource. When that same thing becomes abundant, it freaks people out. And not just in a practical way, like what do we do with abundant printing as the printing press created, it actually takes on a moral dimension. When something goes from being scarce to being abundant, the people who are used to the scarce system almost always speak in moralizing terms, as Poe and as Martin Luther did. So what we're seeing now with the internet is the same explosion of abundant production, abundant forms, people writing only to hear themselves heard, as Luther said, people writing and sort of putting out so much material that you have to wade through, as Poe complained about. It's happening again, And again, the abundance being created by the internet is being discussed not in practical terms, what do we as a society do about it, but often in the same kinds of moral terms that Poe and Luther used.
So you argue that the internet has fundamentally restored or is in the process of restoring reading and writing to their previous places in our society.
Well, it's not exactly their previous places, which is to say the kind of reading and writing people are doing now is plainly different from the kind of reading and writing.
But to a more central place.
But absolutely. There is this vision out there right now being promulgated by the cadre of hand-wringers that makes it seem as if we were all reading each other Proust by candlelight right up until the day YouTube launched. And they don't tell the story of the effect of television on reading, right? It was Sanford and Son that did it in Proust, not the internet. What the internet does actually is to bring reading and writing back as a central activity, albeit one practiced in very different ways than it was practiced in the first half of the 20th century.
So, in other words, we were wasting all this time that we have because of the cognitive surplus, because of the modern work world, at least in the West, in the industrialized world. We were wasting it as a culture in general, watching television, being passive, staring at a tube. And the internet, if it's replacing television as the dominant media activity, it's making us smarter, not dumber, because it's interactive. It's reading and writing.
Right. And the cognitive surplus, the idea of a cognitive surplus, the sort of networked free time and talents of the world, has really two pieces. One is the thing you were talking about, the free time that started to grow, started to become abundant as we move from being an agrarian to being an industrial and then a post-industrial society. We've got over a trillion hours a year in the educated world of this free time. But without a medium that rewarded that free time for any kind of active use, the free time was just something we had to use up, and we mostly used it up watching television. What the internet does isn't to create the internet isn't creating new forms. What it's doing is it's giving us an opportunity to work with each other, right? It's human motivation driving this thing, not the technology. And it's giving us the opportunity to get together and do things together, even if it's as simple as just cracking each other up. That's still a creative rather than a passive act.
Critics will say the internet is a galaxy wide but an inch deep. So we may be reading and writing, but our attention span is about 200 words. So forget about Proust or anything.
Well, so first of all, to the issue of distraction and attention span, that, it seems to me, is the very real problem, right? In exactly the same way in the 1600s and 1700s, society confronted the idea that if we were going to take advantage of the printing press, society was going to have to spend an unbelievable amount of resources teaching children to read. We're pretty clearly going to have to do that around questions of distraction. When that gets bundled up with the kind of genuflection to Proust and Tolstoy, right, the canonical worry beads of the English majors Uber Alles set.
Like people were reading those all over Akron.
Exactly. I mean, well, it has nothing to do with Akron. Like people were reading those all over the 90s. You know, the idea that the 19th century European novel should somehow be restored to its preeminent place that it enjoyed in the first half of the 20th century is a completely separate question and, frankly, a lost battle relative to the question of how do we maintain focus in a world where we can now opt into as many distractions as we like. And one of the things I have consistently been arguing for is that the kind of retrograde concerns for Proust and Tolstoy, which had already passed out of mainstream society, are in fact a distraction from thinking about distractions, which is the real problem before us.
And your Wall Street Journal op-ed excerpt or summary of your book was headlined, "Does the Internet Make You Smarter?" And I wonder if that was a response to Nicholas Carr's article in The Atlantic, which actually he's going to be back on the show next week to talk about the new book based on.
Right.
The Atlantic article was, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?"
Right.
And when he was on the show to talk about that article, this is a little bit of what he had to say about the internet.
We begin to lose our capacity not only for deep reading, but for any kind of sustained concentration or even contemplation. And I think it's those things, concentration and contemplation, that really have been central to the development of culture, really, over the last 500 years, at least, since the introduction of the printing press.
So Nicholas Carr is the anti-you, and you're the anti-him.
Well,
but, I want to get the two of you together in a room for about 2 hours.
I want that, too. I mean, I'm often presented as being the anti-Carr, although I have always consistently said in public that Carr is the smartest of the pessimists and the one whose opinions are most worth paying attention to. And what he just said, I think, is correct. The difference between Carr and I is that looking back at the history of print, I continually reflect on the fact, and mentioned in the journal article, that we got erotic literature 100 years before we got scientific journals. Actually, the cheap stuff is the stuff that always appears first because it's cheap. It's easy to do. The throwaway culture is the thing that immediately appears. And the longer-term buildup of the cultural value, like the idea of peer review and print publications, takes time. What Nick is saying about the individual human mind is, I think, the piece of that book we need to deal with. Where he and I think might disagree is that I have great faith in humankind's ability to create social structures that take the possibilities of new media and make them civically valuable, not just endlessly distracting. He, on the other hand, is a pessimist, does not believe society is going to do that, at least this time.
Quick example of those social structures developing now?
Well, so patience like me is one of the ones that I focus on in the book because it is such a bold experiment. Patience like me is a site where patients, sufferers of often rare, often horrible diseases, Lou Gehrig's disease is one of the ones they have the most patients for, come together and share an incredible amount of information about themselves, their symptoms, their medications, how often they suffer, how they suffer, and
you can find this in almost any disease. Category online.
Exactly. And the goal of patients like me isn't just to make those people feel better by giving them a supportive community. It's actually to change the way medical research proceeds. They have now assembled a pool of sufferers from Lou Gehrig's disease that is 10 times larger than that assembled by any pharmaceutical and hundreds of times larger, literally hundreds of times larger than any existing study.
Aha. But this may bring us to a question being asked by Jim in the Bronx. Jim, you're on WNYC. Let's hope I got the segue right.
Hi. I'm an educator. I teach history in the CUNY system. I have most of the reading I have my students do are online reading, but the biggest problem is teaching them how to critically judge what's credible and not.
Uh-huh.
I'm really disturbed in finding many of them read these things that are conspiracy theories, these sci-fi theories, all kinds of nonsense. And they don't know how to judge what's credible from what's not credible. That's a really big concern.
Mm-hmm. And Clay, this can happen in history, and this can happen in reading about medicine.
Exactly, it can happen anywhere. So, what do you tell them?
Well, I have very strict rules as to what I will accept and not accept as research, for instance, for papers. I go, we review readings in class, but I tell them anyone can say anything online. It doesn't make it true. I constantly repeat that claim. Anyone can say anything. It doesn't make it true.
And do they get it?
In principle, but that still doesn't teach them how to judge what's credible or what's not credible. That's a slow process.
But then, Jim, do you want all information to be curated by McGraw-Hill?
Not all information, no. But there is something to be said about gatekeeping functions. I mean, there is something valuable to that.
No, of course. I think Brian's question is more, do you want only gatekept information or do you want a mix of – I mean, we certainly have now plenty of sites where there is a strong gatekeeping function, right? You can go to conspiracy.com or you can go to the newyorktimes.com. And you – as long as you understand the difference between the kinds of things that appear in the two different arenas, you can start to make those distinctions. It is as essential to teach children the difference between what personal opinion and what kind of communally edited material looks like, as it was to teach them the difference between newspapers and comic books in the print era. Certainly, the current abundance, which has appeared so rapidly, has caught us by surprise, and we don't yet have the language to talk to children about the different genres. Right? I've got a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, and I have to sit down with them and say roughly the same thing. Although they certainly don't have free run of the internet yet, for the obvious reasons.
But you historically. To go back to the Gutenberg, dawn of the printing press analogy, you said widespread literary education. was the necessary response to the huge increase in essentially bad information that, you know, the mass medium of books was starting to spread around the culture centuries ago. What's the equivalent cultural response today?
Well, there are a couple of cultural responses. One of them, you know, one of the things that people don't realize about the rise of the print revolution is it wasn't until after print became abundant that we started separating fiction from nonfiction. That wasn't a division that existed until there were so many stories that people could start sorting that out that idea. So one of the things we need to teach kids to do is to understand something about the context in which work is produced. So here is a blog by an individual on a particular topic, and are there any signs that that person is knowledgeable about that topic? If so, you can take that at, you know, as some kind of evidence. If not, you pay less attention to that person's opinion until you see it corroborated. And so in a way, we have switched, right? There's always been this great tension between, you know, Socratic and Platonic ideas of authority, right? And Socrates is get the smart people together and get them to keep talking. Plato had a more sort of we can identify the authorities and put them in charge, right? No poets in the land of the Republic. We're all moving to Socratic norms now, which is to say we're all moving to a position where we're like the editors of peer-reviewed journals. We have to assess things probabilistically. Instead of saying this person is an authority, that person is not, I am only listening to A, now we're really having to say on the balance, you know, this is a strange story I just read, but I've seen it written about three times from uncoordinated sources, so I'm going to start to take it seriously. And what Jim said is, you know, the first thing we have to do is to educate children that not – in fact, educate everyone, educate ourselves – that not all pieces of information are created equal. And after that, the social problem becomes how do we teach people to get that kind of probability signature for the value of information rather than this is an authority, that is not an authority.
I see this show in that context that – since we started before the internet, it used to be much more experts with certifiable knowledge coming on to impart that knowledge to a receptive audience. Over time, it has become much more of a hybrid of the wisdom of the crowd, if you will,
right,
interacting with the wisdom of experts, not competing with it necessarily, but interacting
sure
with it, and the kind of fact-checking process and larger peer review process goes in all directions now.
Right. No, that's that, and I think the ability of surprising voices to be surfaced is one of the great and profound advantages of this medium. My friend Naomi Wolf many years ago wrote a book called The Beauty Myth. And she
was here to talk about it.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. So in that book, she looked at the role of women's magazines as a potential place where women could have a conversation with one another unshaped by larger social forces, and the way that women's magazines almost completely failed to live up to that possibility because of the demands of cosmetics company for beauty-friendly copy. And so the possibility of discussing real and deep issues of sexism was driven from the one place that provided this public conversation. Now when you look at Melissa McEwen on Shakespeare's Shakesville or Sadie Doyle at Tiger Beatdown, who's my favorite blogger, they are doing what Naomi imagined. They have a public space to not just say what they think, but to convene a conversation among their commenters without having to go hat in hand to the cosmetics company and have beauty-friendly copy. They can finally have the discussion out in the open.
Last thing. There was that New York Times article this week, Hooked on Gadgets and Paying a Mental Price.
Yes.
And that's probably top of mind for a lot of listeners,
right,
because it encapsulated the concerns that a lot of people have, that heavy multitaskers actually have more trouble focusing and shutting out irrelevant information, even when they're not online. For example, it cited almost 30% of those under age 45 say the use of gadgets makes it harder to focus, while only 10% of older adult users agreed.
Yeah. No, well, the ancient vaudeville diagnosis is the appropriate one here. Doctor, it hurts when I do this? Well, don't do that. I had dinner with Cory Doctorow, who's quoted in Carr's book, In the Shallows, as saying, you know, the internet's a distraction engine. And it was, you know, internet royalty, a dozen people sort of gathered together, and the first 45 minutes of the conversation were what people were doing to shut off notifications, not get as many email alerts. People are starting to respond, I think, both to the conditions of their own life and to the unambiguous
knowing
research.
When enough is enough.
Knowing when enough is enough.
Do you buy the brain research reports that say that it literally rewires your brain?
Of course, but everything rewires your brain. This is the trick of the shallows. Everything rewires your brain. Your brain is there to be rewired. The research that I think is important is that multitasking is damaging, and we should all be taking steps, as I do, to reduce the amount of interrupt-driven nature that the devices provide, and instead to go back to being the boss of the devices instead of the other way around.
Clay Shirky, author of Cognitive Surplus, Creativity and Generosity in a Connected Age. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.